Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm joined tonight for a discussion of some missteps for the first time since Scary Movie Month ended by JB.
Everything is beautiful and nothing hurts.
You can find our website at fthismovie.net. Follow us on Twitter, we're at F This Movie. You should like us on Facebook if you haven't already, and you should email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. We're going to be talking about some bad to flawed movies made by some of our favorite directors tonight. But before we do that, J-Bones, since the end of Scary Movie Month, have you seen anything good?
Yes. I've seen one thing that was good and one thing that was interesting.
Okay.
And I like bad. Interesting.
Oh.
I saw All Is Lost.
Okay.
And I liked it, as we've discussed previously, didn't love it,
right.
Which seems to be what this year's banner will read at the end of the year. I liked it, I didn't love it. It's an impressive piece of work. I'm really starting to like these movies that have a much narrower focus. I think Gravity did a lot of similar things.
Yeah.
And I don't think this has happened in a while. You're a much better barometer of this, that Hollywood gets an idea, and then we have all these movies
right,
come out.
Right.
The go-to example is the body switching movies from that
right.
sad
the late
epic.
80s.
And lately, the theme of this year seems to be stay alive through incredible odds, because I'm seeing a big similarity between Captain Phillips, All Is Lost, and Gravity.
Sure.
That
one person trying to survive.
Yeah, and I would really recommend All Is Lost, if only for the way it's filmed. And I think it's challenging to have a film with no dialogue.
Should I know who directed that? For some reason, I thought it was Bennett Miller, but that is coming from nowhere, and
no,
that is a stupid
I don't
guess.
Think so, and I'm okay. not going to grab my phone and look it up. But
yeah, that's
the,
fine.
The gentleman in question has a very foreign sound.
And then it is not Bennett Miller.
And except for a little narration at the beginning and one very well-placed swear word, it's virtually a silent performance, and I think sometimes we forget how difficult that is. Robert Redford is just extraordinary. The old man in the sea. And then, finally, we get to the elephant in the room.
Chris Christie?
You know those people who don't like your politics are just going
to... I'm not making... It's a reference to the Time magazine cover. I'm not making fun of Chris Christie.
He lost some weight.
I'm not criticizing Chris Christie.
He hates teachers. I'm criticizing him.
It was on the cover of Time magazine.
I don't remember a politician who I like as a person...
Right.
...and hate everything he stands for.
Yeah.
It's the definition of ambiguity. In any case...
Yes.
I finally saw Escape from Tomorrow.
Okay.
And I actually saw it in a theater. I didn't wimp out and watch it on demand.
The way I'm going to see it.
And I would argue that it was the film that I was most looking forward to this year.
Wow.
For a number of reasons. And it's awful.
Really?
It is awful. I went with high expectations. It's not that I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
It's not that it dashed my expectations. I don't even mind that it's sort of dark. In fact, it's very dark. But I think the filmmakers were so entranced with what they were doing.
Yeah.
Or what they were getting away with.
Yeah.
I gotta say, my hat is off.
Right.
It's a mess.
Uh-uh.
It seems like there were three different scripts that were somehow stitched together.
Surely they were kind of making it up on the fly, right? Depending on where they could shoot and what they could get.
Things come up that are intriguing, and they're dropped. It's about a husband and wife and their two kids, as you probably know, and they go to Disneyland, and all hell breaks loose. And the two leads are so unsympathetic and grating. We start off with this mother who's a shrew and a harridan, and this father who's just hopeless and awful. And is it to make fun of the nuclear family?
Right, right.
Is it what is the point here? It's just odd. It seems to be you know, the worst tendency of a student film to just shit on everything. And what I really object to in the film, and this is specifically for people who saw it and might have liked it, I'd like those people to at least admit that a central flaw of the film, no matter what else you say about it, is it wants to be hyper-realistic until that doesn't work. And then it becomes surreal and weird.
Okay.
And I would argue you have to pick.
Okay. You don't think it was a specific choice to sort of...
I don't know why anyone would choose to do that, and I would challenge anyone who likes the film to explain to me why at some points we're supposed to accept this as objective reality.
Okay.
And then other times, clearly someone's hallucinating, it's surreal. You need to pick a tone.
Right.
I think if they had done that, if they had worked out the script problems, one shot in the trailer remains my favorite shot, and I thought that was going to be what the film was going to explore. They went into Snow White's scary adventure,
right.
That dark ride.
Right.
And between the slow motion and the black and white, the ride vehicle sort of comes upon the dwarfs. Do you know the shot I'm talking about in the trailer?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the creepiest goddamn thing you've ever seen. So through point of view, if you can make the happiest place on earth into this other thing, I applaud you, but it's a mess.
Well, that's disappointing. Not that I had high expectations, because like a lot of other people, I was mostly interested in it as a curiosity to see what is this thing that they made. I didn't have expectations for it one way or another. So
I've talked to people, it's their favorite film of the year.
Interesting. Would you consider it a horror movie? Not to go back to Scary Movie Month, a number of people did a 7-word review of it during Scary Movie Month, and I didn't feel like challenging that because I hadn't seen it.
And I believe I did, but only because I wanted to get to 31. And I didn't think it would be challenged.
So it's not really a horror movie?
No. You could make a case
horror-ish.
For
horror-ish, yeah. I mean, I heard somebody, maybe Adam Risky, maybe somebody else, sort of compared it maybe to, like, Eraserhead at points, which you could argue is a horror movie.
A big, big disappointment.
Well, that's unfortunate. I saw a couple of things that were pretty bad, and one thing that was really great. So, I saw a movie called The Lifeguard, starring Kristen Bell, and a bunch of other people that you would recognize. Meryl Streep's daughter, who shows up in everything, and Martin Starr. It's about a 30-year-old girl who sort of has this crisis and goes home and lives with her parents and goes back to, she takes her high school job back and starts sleeping with a high school boy. It's garbage. It's not a good movie.
For a second, when you said the title, there's a 1970s movie.
Sam Elliott,
Lifeguard.
That's just Lifeguard, yeah.
And I thought this was a remake. You can see the pitch meeting. Here's the twist. It's Kristen Bell.
It's a bad movie, and again, I watched it the whole time just wondering how some movies get made and how they attract a star. You know, Kristen Bell is a movie star who read this and seemed to think, this is a great part, and agreed to do this movie that is not very good. And then I saw Touchy Feely, which is the new movie from Lynn Shelton. About, again, a bunch of famous people in it. Rosemary DeWitt, Ellen Page, a few others whose names aren't coming to me right now. Lynn Shelton made Hump Day, which was great. She made My Sister's Sister? I don't know. That was problematic, and this movie is a big mess. It's one of these movies that has sort of an indie feel to it, and it's great at approximating the vibe of that kind of movie, that you're like, oh, I kind of like the vibe of this, but it's also sort of pretentious and messy and doesn't connect in any of the ways that I think it's supposed to.
And when you say vibe, it's, I will go along with this and forgive its flaws.
Right.
Because I'm for what it's trying to do.
Right. It's about Rosemary DeWitt plays a masseuse who suddenly develops sort of this aversion/repulsion to touching other people. And it sort of reminded me, in that one little aspect of it, did you ever see Safe, the Todd Haynes movie?
Yeah.
That movie's great. And that was, that movie's way better at doing.
What else has Rosemary DeWitt been in?
She was Rachel in Rachel Getting Married.
Okay. I really like her.
She's very talented.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's really, really good. And she's fine in the movie. Everybody's fine in the movie. It's just that it's not a very good movie.
And she's usually wasted, because even in Rachel Getting Married, she's not the lead.
No, she's not the lead, but you can see it's... I do think Anne Hathaway is really good in that movie, because I think it plays to so many of her actressy strengths. but Rosemary DeWitt is sort of doing... She's the Tom Cruise to Anne Hathaway's Rain Man, where you're like, oh, you're doing something much harder, because you have to be the normal one.
Yeah.
The last thing I saw is a documentary that Sarah Polley directed that came out earlier this year called Stories We Tell.
I've read a lot about this.
It's fantastic. It's sort of about her family, and just I won't say much more because it continues to unfold. She
discovers some things.
Yeah, about her own family, and it's just interviews with her family. It does so many interesting things. For a little while, I was actually kind of irritated by it. I thought it was a little too precious and a little self-indulgent. And then slowly it starts to come together and you realize, oh, this is all very deliberate and it's not just about what it's about. It's about how stories are told, even in movie form, and the way that filmmakers can trick you into certain things. And her father gives this amazing monologue at the end of the movie about sort of storytelling and what it means. It's really, really good. Everybody should see it.
I find that that's true of the documentaries of Errol Morris.
Yeah.
That there's so much else going on.
Right.
But that his artistry is that he's sort of hiding.
Right. Although I never saw his most recent.
Oh, because he was Tabloid, right?
That was the one.
Oh.
It's not about a couple.
I recommend that. I recommended that a dog's age ago.
Yeah.
On Netflix, this movie.
Yeah.
And I actually saw that in a theater.
Nice.
My God, his movies are just wonderful wells full of joy.
All right, so let's get into the main event. We were trying to come up with an idea for a show this week, and for some reason the movie Gangs of New York popped into my head, because I think it's a movie worth talking about, and that wasn't going to work out, so then we came up with this idea of, well, in that spirit, let's talk about some flawed movies from some directors that we like, so it's sort of a theme show.
Okay, and right now I'm going to take my pants down.
Okay.
Because I'm going to, well, you know.
What?
Okay, that went nowhere. Forget it.
I didn't get it.
That I was going to shit on something.
Oh, got it. Okay. Oh. I went with, with movies that I actually like that I think are flawed, or they're either flawed or masterpieces. I'm not sure.
And the more I thought about this,
yeah.
Because originally this homework assignment seemed easy. Take some directors you like,
yeah,
and find their worst film.
Sure.
But when I really looked at the directors that I like, I started to discover this is kind of eerie. Exactly what you just said.
Yeah.
So this might turn out to be a twisted, weird love fest.
So what is the first director slash movie for you?
Okay. I'm looking at my notes, and I just want to figure out where to start. I thought we'd start with Hitchcock.
Okay.
And I'm looking at Hitchcock, and I was actually lucky enough back in the days that education was an exciting adventure and people weren't worried about GPAs and test scores. One of the first film classes I took at U of I was an entire semester about Hitchcock,
mm-hmm,
taught by Robert Carringer, and it was an amazing class. It was really, really good. And so I'm looking at the career of Hitchcock because I think Hitchcock is the greatest American director. Deceased.
Right.
I would hand greatest living American director. Who would you hand it to?
Oh, gosh.
Because every time I say this person's name, I preface it with
It's hard. I mean, a lot of people say Scorsese.
And that's who I was thinking of.
I would say Scorsese or Spielberg.
He's the greatest living director. And speaking of directors, I had to refresh my memory, so I went on the IMDb, heebie-jeebie. And successful directors?
Yes.
I couldn't believe how many things Spielberg has produced.
Yeah.
There's not enough hours in the day. What is that?
Well, in the 80s, it was more about he was a brand, so his name just showed up on a lot of stuff. I can't imagine that he was...
Yeah, there's no possible way.
Although, supposedly, in that new Corey Feldman biography, Choreography, he claims that Spielberg shot all the second unit stuff on The Goonies, which I thought was fascinating.
Well, I might believe that. Yeah. I mean, say what you want. Spielberg loves to do the job.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at IMDb, and for Spielberg, it's like, director, 50 movies. Yeah. But again, that's even a little inflated, because they count shorts. Producer, 145. Really? So back to Hitchcock.
Yes.
I'm looking at Hitchcock's filmography, and I'm trying to find the misstep, and I would argue that the misstep is Marnie.
Okay. I thought for sure you were going to say that version of Psycho he made with Vince Vaughn.
Well, Patrick, a little film history. Hitchcock was dead.
What?
But
Who could have made Psycho?
Gus Van Sant. I might have brought this up in a column a couple years ago. Gus Van Sant actually took the trouble of digging up Hitchcock's grave, taking his skull, doing that unmentionable sexual act to it, and then I believe I said he made it into an ashtray to keep his loose change, because that's how much respect he had for Hitchcock. Tangent. Early in Hitchcock's career, he made a film called Under Capricorn.
Okay.
And no one's seen it.
No.
And no one should see it.
Got it.
And I don't know why, but it's this weird anomaly. It's this Technicolor costume picture with Ingrid Bergman, and it defines tedium.
Right.
But let's go to Hitchcock's golden era.
Okay.
After The Birds, he still has Tippi Hedren under contract, and he makes Marnie. And Marnie has its defenders, but Marnie is not very good. But thinking about that in terms of a director making missteps, it led me to another proclamation, another observation, which I thought we could explore. Is there any director who gets really famous who doesn't, I don't want to say goes down the wrong path or something, but I'm looking at Hitchcock specifically, and Psycho and The Birds are such big hits, and I think it was, not Raymond Durrett, it'll come to me in a second. There's a wonderful book called The Long Hard Look at Psycho. It's on the tip of my tongue, that he suggested that Psycho ruined Hitchcock, that the success of Psycho not only doomed him to try to catch the lightning again and again, but I would argue, and Marnie really points to this, that either because he was getting older, it seems to me that not only is Marnie a misstep, but it sets the tone for his rest of his career, because either he's so disinterested in the process, it almost seems like the last couple films Hitch made, he thought there really only had to be one good sequence. That the shower scene is so famous that you get an attempt to replicate it. I would argue there's actually three scenes, three sequences in The Birds that are just tour de forces.
Sure.
When they attack the town with the gasoline and she's in the phone booth, and later when they attack the house. And then, of course, that very contentious scene where they attack her in the attic. And how did they film that? But from Marnie on, it seems that Hitch thinks, as long as you craft one thing, and there's a heist sequence in Marnie that's just, ooh, this is how you do it.
Yeah, right.
And then in Frenzy, and we commented on this when they showed it at the massacre, there's that middle fifth, it might not even be the middle. And you had commented, because you had never seen the film before, that you thought it was over.
Yeah, for sure. He gets on the back of the truck and you think it's over, right?
And then
he's trying to get something back, right? He left something behind, and he's trying, right?
He left something on her.
Yeah.
Because he's got to go through the potatoes.
Right.
And that sequence is amazing, and then the rest of the film is just... and then Torn Curtain, which has this amazing sequence where two guys fight in a room. And Hitchcock said, well, what if it wasn't a movie fight? What if it was really like if two guys were really trying to kill each other?
Yeah.
It involves an oven. And it's amazing. And the rest of the film is awful. It's Paul Newman and Julie Andrews. And then Topaz, I'm trying to remember. See, I saw all these films in this class because nobody watches Topaz anymore. And it's in the box set.
Yes, it is.
That I would say every film he made after The Birds was a misstep, including Family Plot, which some people like. But it's like him trying to make a Hitchcock film.
Right. Is it him trying to imitate himself? I remember Quentin Tarantino being interviewed.
I was just...
A year ago on Stern, right? And he talked about Billy Wilder. He wants to get out before he starts going through his shit period. And he pointed to Billy Wilder. Billy Wilder makes all these great movies. And then in the 70s, mostly, he makes...
His version of The Front Page is unwatchable.
Yeah.
Buddy Buddy.
That's, I think, the movie that he says is...
Have you ever seen Avanti?
I don't think I have ever seen Avanti.
Jack Lemmon and Juliette Mills, and it's supposed to be this light
souffle, I haven't seen it.
And it takes place in Italy, and it is just... So I'm glad you brought up the Tarantino thing, because obviously I don't want to begrudge a man a living, but I don't know what he had to prove. Make The Birds and stop.
Right. I mean, so maybe it's a function of getting older. I mean, we talk about it, especially with horror directors all the time, that you look at John Carpenter's last movie and you don't understand how he was ever John Carpenter. And while I won't segue into Scorsese just yet.
I want to segue into Scorsese.
I like The Departed a lot. I think Goodfellas is probably Scorsese's last, like, holy shit masterpiece. And he's got several. And, you know, a lot of filmmakers get maybe one or two. I have liked all of Scorsese's movies in varying degrees in the last 20 years. I haven't loved a lot of them, but I would argue that he's one of the few who hasn't lost it.
Exactly. That's what I thought the segue could be, because I immediately turned to Scorsese, and I'm looking for missteps, and I don't really think he has any. Even the minor films, what I might classify minor films like Bringing Out the Dead, I think are very enjoyable. And I know we differ on this, but Hugo is an impressive piece of work.
Mm-hmm.
I think I forgave the first half hour because I found it charming.
Sure.
And children's bookish.
Sure.
And I know on a recent podcast, Doug brought up that perhaps Chloe Grace Moretz is miscast.
Sure.
But it just reminded me of a children's book that I would find charming when I was 10, with the cop who's trying to find him and all that nonsense. But the minute it gets to Méliès, and I've said this before, I thought the movie was made for me.
Right.
And clearly shows Scorsese's feelings about a lot of things.
And it's interesting, too, that he's able to make that movie succeed. And again, you like it more than I do. But he is working in a very different genre. He hadn't really made sort of a quote-unquote children's film before.
Not that it's 3D.
Right. Not that it's necessarily a children's film.
Would you agree that the 3D was interesting?
There's very few movies I've seen in 3D that I thought... I liked seeing all the post-converted Méliès stuff. I thought that was cool.
To be fair, folks, we got there late.
Oh, yeah, we had bad seats.
And we had seats...
Yeah.
Where you might argue we could not...
That is correct. Yeah, it was hard to see the 3D at the angle at which we were sitting.
At now, the beginning, when we're going through the clock gears and things, I thought that was...
He definitely, I mean, knows how to use it. I'm just of the feeling that, like, yeah, but you don't need to. Okay, but you say this, that Scorsese has no missteps, having not seen Gangs of New York, correct?
Correct, and I apologize, my son has been after me to see it because he's a big fan.
It's a mess, but it's a mess that I find myself really liking, and I can't understand why, which is why I had thrown out that we do a podcast on it.
And I had a question for you,
yes.
Because, and again, this is coming from ignorance. Is any of the messiness of Gangs of New York, does it have to do with the fact that Daniel Day-Lewis is in it?
Yes and no. I mean... He's great in it. He's insanely over the top, even more so than Daniel Plainview. I mean, he's playing a cartoon character, and it's okay because it sort of matches the tone of the movie. It's two movies kind of split. Leonardo DiCaprio is not up to snuff. Cameron Diaz might be miscast. It's interesting because I know that it was like a passion project for years for Scorsese. He wanted to get it made. He spent a fortune on it. And I was excited to see it because it was a Scorsese movie. You know, he's made all these movies about gangsters in New York, but here's gangsters in New York, you know, late 1800s or whatever. So I was super excited to see it, and the movie opens, and there's this amazing shot, and I remember sitting in the theater, I think on opening day, thinking, like, this is the best movie of the year, and 10 minutes later, it was like, no, it isn't. There's tons to like in it, it's super interesting, and for whatever reason, I find myself wanting to revisit that movie more than a lot of his other movies that I think work better.
So, two comments here. Because I haven't seen it, but yes. I intend to.
We should do a podcast on it when you see it.
I have this new TV that I like to spin things on.
Yes.
Because old things look new. that after my left foot, and I think maybe Adams commented on this, there's this Daniel Day-Lewis effect where I think directors are hesitant to shape the performance, and the performance begins to shape the film.
Yeah.
Now,
that may be true.
No disrespect. He's a hell of an actor.
Right.
But he's a very specific type of actor.
He does perhaps steamroll the movie a little bit. And I don't know how much of that is because Leonardo DiCaprio, who I've seen be great in stuff, is either not, wasn't quite there yet, or maybe he just is a victim of being steamrolled. I don't know.
And again, this was a case where sometimes I'll see something and it'll take me a while to process it, and then I'll have to see it again. And that happened with Synecdoche, New York, where my first viewing just left me flummoxed. I was so overwhelmed by it, and then I saw it a couple more times. And it's a masterpiece that the first time I saw There Will Be Blood,
yeah,
I had many problems. And now, every time I watch it again, I just think that's a performance for the ages.
Yeah.
I think it's a performance that you've never seen.
Yeah.
And infinitely imitatable. But I also thought I wanted to use that as a segue to DiCaprio, where I began to wonder if Scorsese was getting certain films bankrolled because of his association with DiCaprio.
Sure.
And whether that might not have been the best relationship for him artistically.
I don't think they've ever created anything on the level of him and De Niro, you know. Again, their movies, a lot of their collaborations are fine. I like Gangs of New York. It's a mess. I like a lot of The Aviator. It's a mess. Shutter Island, I think you like a little bit more than me, but it's a fine sort of psychological thriller.
It's a minor genre exercise. And the trailer for Wolf of Wall Street, I'm really afraid is going to be better than the movie.
If the movie can sustain that pitch.
Whoever chose the music.
It's
going to
be great. Oh, yeah.
Whoever chose that tune.
Well, and DiCaprio looks like he's having fun, which he maybe never does in a movie, except for Django Unchained.
And I often like DiCaprio, and as much as I loathe the film, I thought he was very good in Gatsby, and wished they could have built, speaking of Daniel Day-Lewis, what if they could have built a film around that performance?
Yeah.
Because I thought he was the only thing in that movie worth watching.
I think he's gotten better since working with Scorsese. I think like that has made him step up his game as an actor, because I think you can almost watch him in Gangs of New York. I think that's their first collaboration. And it's problematic. And then I think movie by movie, he continues to get better. And actually, I think he's really great in The Departed, which is a movie that I really liked a lot. I think it was my favorite movie the year that it came out, and I remember thinking, this is the first great Scorsese movie, you know, in a long time. I don't know if it's aged well, and I find myself rarely wanting to revisit it. Even if it's on TV, I won't necessarily put it on.
I think I've seen it twice, and although I liked it and liked a lot of the things he did, I think my experience with Departed was forever tainted by the fact that when the original Japanese version came out, Infernal Affairs,
yeah,
I took my son and some friends to the Music Box to see it, and that was the first time they had ever been to the Music Box. And you've seen the original,
right? I have not seen it.
It's something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something. I mean, and I think they were in high school, and just we were all so blown away by it that that set the bar kind of high.
Right, right.
And then you get plunged into that thing where you sit there and you compare.
Yeah, right.
I wanted to bounce this off you in terms of missteps.
Okay.
Because I wanted to turn our gaze to Mr. Spielberg.
Okay.
Okay. First, 1941.
Yes.
I love that movie.
Yeah, as I was looking at his filmography last night, there are Spielberg messes that I think are terrible, and he's got a few. And then there are Spielberg messes that I really like, and 1941 is one of those.
I think it's really funny.
Yeah, it's way too long.
Well, the adjective I would use is ambitious, because I'm thinking of that fight scene when they're dancing.
Yeah.
And that's...
No, the thing is, like, it's hard to make this argument, especially for people who don't like the movie, and there are lots of people who don't like the movie. The bloat is part of the thing. It's, like, part of the aesthetic.
That's the joke.
Right. And it's hard to make that case to people who hate the movie, where you say, no, it has to be that, so...
I mean, they're dogfighting over Hollywood Boulevard.
Right.
And Aykroyd is saying, I'm a bug. I mean, that's the... And then Robert Stack is crying because he's busy watching Dumbo. I mean, and I was looking at Spielberg's filmography, and God knows, I don't know what genre to classify The Terminal under.
Yeah. Yeah, to me, that's more of a, like, kind of a minor, like,
you know what the Terminal genre is?
What?
2 hours.
Yeah.
The 2 hour genre.
You know, people really like to...
We call it canoodling.
People really like to dump on that movie. I think it's kind of inoffensive, and I'm sure a lot of that has to do with my affection for Tom Hanks. I think movies like Hook and The Lost World, those are on, like, the evil side of bad Spielberg.
What I was going to say is the tragedy of 1941 is, unless I'm ignoring something, he's never made another comedy.
No.
So.
I think that movie taught him, incorrectly, but I think he thinks he can't do comedy.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's a shame. Because I am a diehard, to the day I die, fan of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And you can argue that the bloat is part of the charm.
Right.
If you haven't heard, Criterion.
I did hear that. That's amazing.
And now each Blu-ray is going to be Blu-ray and DVD. So it's coming out in January, February. It's going to have the theatrical version in a 4K transfer. And then a regular high-definition transfer of an extended version that someone who really loves the film has cobbled together.
Finally, an extended cut.
Because when it first... I've owned that on Laserdisc,
yeah,
which was a restoration. And then they put out a DVD that was not the restoration.
I think that's what I have.
And then later a DVD of the restoration.
Which I don't.
But they're all different.
Okay.
Because once it premiered at the Cinerama Dome, someone decided it was too long. You know what I'd like to hear? For those of you who are fans of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, apparently, in its original screenings, it had an intermission. But during the intermission in the lobby, they played radio reports of where
the
police radio.
I can't believe that wouldn't make one of these versions.
So
hopefully
that's something to look forward to. And I think 1941 is a Mad, 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 Mad World.
Sure.
But we were denied other comedies, or maybe they would just be too damn expensive. Because, but here's what's weird. Spielberg becomes so massively successful. I mean, I don't know if we can come up with an adjective for it. That it leads to a syndrome that I think a lot of directors fall prey to. But I think it's especially true of Spielberg. Spielberg is so successful for such a long period of time, I'd call it the tragedy of success.
Yeah.
And I think he's at the point where no one criticizes him. No one offers him notes. He's assumed to be the authority. And that leads to things like AI.
AI is the movie, the specific movie on my list from Spielberg that I was going to talk about. Because AI is one of those movies that I think is either a mess, or a masterpiece?
I go back and forth. Preface, I would love to have seen Kubrick's version.
Sure.
Because that would have been something. But I held this opinion about AI for a really, really long time, and it was either on the radio or on TV just last week. Someone was opining on AI and said exactly what I've been saying.
Where it needs to end?
No, they said, that movie just keeps on ending.
Yeah.
And I've shared this before. When he's stuck in the little submarine.
Yeah.
And he's reaching out for the statue that he cannot have.
Right.
He has become human.
Right.
Because isn't that a metaphor for all of us?
Sure.
And I honestly thought it was going to fade out. And I think there's another 25 minutes.
It advances like thousands, if not millions of years. I remember now, like, oh, I didn't see that coming because now the aliens are here.
It's the famous Mark Twain quote. If I had had more time, I would have written a shorter book. Tangent. Because I brought this up before and people were commenting on it, that you had done a group interp of Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
Yes.
And someone said, they let you do that in high school. Oh, my God. That Patrick and I used to do this thing called group interp, and it's like a little 20-minute play where a group often speaks in unison. They used to call it chamber theater. So anyway, personal tangent. I was once working on one of these misbegotten things, and it was a mess, and another teacher, a colleague of mine, who had actually won state. She had won the state championship. She was in town. She said she would come see it. And she sat through it, and she liked it, because, not to pat myself on the back, it was good. But we were having some problems, and she gave me a piece of advice that I took, a piece of advice I wish Spielberg would take. She said, at this one point, it's done. It's over.
Yeah.
There's nowhere to go. You go there. End it.
Right.
10 minutes
earlier. Yeah.
And that was one of the first pieces I ever did that went to the state championship.
Oh, well.
Because she nailed it. But no one can tell him that anymore. No one can tell him, pick an ending.
Right.
Because all the stuff with the discarded machinery and the Jude Law circus and stuff.
Yes.
It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, and that's the section of the movie to me. I always kind of broke it up into these three parts, that the first third in the house feels very much like a Kubrick movie, where he's almost imitating Kubrick style. And then the middle is crazy Spielberg nightmare.
Yeah.
And then the last third is the thing that he didn't quite crack. And I've tried to warm to the alien ending with basically, where they basically exterminate any past signs of humanity ever by turning this robot off. It feels like a happy ending when you're watching it. Like, why does this have a happy ending? And then you think about what the implications are, and you say, oh, no, all of life as we know it has just been wiped out.
And that's very Kubrickian.
Right. I will say that while Spielberg is definitely at the point where people aren't saying no to him, I do appreciate the fact that, again, like you had said about Hitchcock, Spielberg's career could have just been a series of Jurassic Parks. I think that's sort of where that was maybe his last sort of big crowd-pleasing, that sort of populist movie that he does better than anyone. And it would have led to a career full of Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skulls, I think, where he's trying to recapture this thing and he can't do it. But instead, for the most part, he's doing weird, interesting sort of things.
And I give him so much credit for something like Amistad, which is very odd.
Yeah.
But I can't say I love it, but I really like the fact that that film has that long speech at the end.
Yeah.
What other director would get away with that? And on the same token, I don't remember what you thought of Lincoln.
I thought it was fine. I don't love Lincoln. It's not one of my favorite Spielberg movies of the last 10 years.
Lincoln. I like Lincoln a lot.
Yeah.
And was really impressed. Well, first of all, I heard a lot of people say that they were disappointed.
Yeah, right?
Because
it cuts before, you don't even see
it. Because they found an artistic way of representing that. What I really, I don't love Lincoln, but what I did love about it is that much more so than the life of famous presidents, that film was really about what you have to do to be in politics.
That was all the stuff that I liked about it.
Yeah. But it wasn't just a standard rapscallion offering people bribes.
It wasn't just
And that's a cool performance.
Standard biopic. But yeah, I mean, Minority Report, again, I don't love, but it's interesting. War of the Worlds is messy, but interesting. Munich, I think, is amazing.
And War of the Worlds is the opposite of AI. I think War of the Worlds needs a third act.
It absolutely does. Yeah. But a pretty impressive first two acts, especially the first one. The middle one's a little rougher with the Tim Robbins stuff, but the first act of that movie...
Oh, no. I love the first act.
It's the scariest stuff in any movie.
And as people who read my column know, I was recently at Universal, and they left that set up because they just thought it would be so cool to drive the tram through it. The plane crash thing?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Even on the studio tour. One last thing about AI that I wanted to add, because I have a personal memory of AI. AI was the first movie I ever saw where someone's cell phone went off halfway through the film. And I was really invested halfway through the film, and it just yanked me out. And I think it's because I have a friend who works for the Daily Herald, and I related this. Jan and Jake and I were in the Daily Herald in a story about
cell phones
and
movie theater?
Bad movie behavior.
Yeah.
And it even had a little picture of us. And like the caption was, the movie was destroyed for them.
It like arms folded, sad face?
All three of us, I was actually in this room.
Holding up your ticket?
With the Phantom Stallion behind us.
Yeah.
And in the picture, all three of us looked vaguely angry. I don't know if that was deliberate, but that was actually in the Daily Herald. And I still remember that. That was the beginning of the scourge of cell phones.
AI for me is the Spielberg, the flawed but interesting Spielberg movie that I really like. And it may segue, unless you had a better segue, but since we brought up Stanley Kubrick.
Yes, we must speak of Kubrick.
Okay. Do you have a movie on the list for Kubrick?
Yes, although recently, I don't know where I read this, someone was going on and on about how much they didn't like Lolita.
It came up a couple times because when we talked about doing this podcast, then that became the weekend weigh-in question because I'm unoriginal and incapable of creativity. So I just made that the weekend weigh-in question. And a few people had mentioned that they are not, that was their least favorite Kubrick movie.
That might be my most favorite.
I think you've said that, yeah.
Just endlessly.
Yeah.
Although part of that might be James Mason's performance, because Mason was never given an opportunity to do that. There's a little bit of it around the edges in North by Northwest. And have you seen Bigger Than Life yet?
The first 15 minutes, like three times.
Okay.
And I've never made it further.
Because...
Not because I don't like it, but just...
Because I told you... An hour in, that movie goes so deliriously off the track. Made when?
Well, Nicholas Ray was a maniac.
So my reaction to Lolita might be because James Mason is great, but you brought up Kubrick.
Yes.
And I'm hoping you brought up Kubrick to talk about...
Well, I haven't seen Spartacus, so I can't speak to Spartacus.
And Spartacus is atypical.
Right.
Because he was a director for hire.
Right.
Kirk Douglas got such rave reviews for Paths of Glory that when the director on Spartacus was fired, Kubrick was brought in. I always wonder if those extreme long shot battles were Kubrick's doing. Because it's so rare in a Hollywood film, you usually get real close and you see the spear going in.
Are we talking about Spartacus?
Yeah, okay. It's made really personal. A lot of the battles are seen almost like you're watching a football game from the worst seat in the house, and you see large groups of people moving, and it makes it look like a chessboard.
Yeah.
And he seems... It's very atypical for a Hollywood blockbuster, though. But let's not talk about Spartacus. I know the film you're going to bring up.
Is it Eyes Wide Shut?
You bet.
Okay.
I hate that film.
And for me, it might be a masterpiece. I'm not sure.
Explain to me why.
I can't.
I understand why I might be blinded to some of the film's greatness.
Yeah. But again, to Tom Cruise's credit, that movie is atypical of his career. I think he, like Steven Spielberg, at a certain point started taking more interesting movies. He's worked with better directors than anyone maybe ever. I mean, any great director, Tom Cruise has worked with them, and you know, usually in an interesting movie. But the way that that movie sort of confronts his public image and his celebrity, I think is really interesting. I'm not saying he's great in the movie, but I think it's almost a brilliant case of stunt casting.
And clearly I've read a lot about it, and he and Nicole were married then, and they committed this amount of time, and Kubrick kept them there forever.
You can almost feel them start to hate each other, like, which works for the movie, but, I mean, they split up not super long after that.
And Kubrick's famous for that already, right. But I've read that the number of takes he did was just, yeah. It would stretch your patience. The thing I find most interesting about Eyes Wide Shut is, because Kubrick had this phobia against traveling and things, is that film takes place in New York.
Right? Yes.
They recreated that neighborhood
in
England.
Yes.
And you watch that movie, that's some art direction, baby. And you see when he's outside at night walking around, that is not a small set.
It was on IFC last night. I'm incapable of turning it off when it comes on. The way that the camera tracks that crazy, repetitive one finger plinking on the piano that I've sung to people since 1999 when I saw it opening night.
I like both of those things. Let's get to the club at the end.
Okay.
That comes across as someone who's very out of touch with reality or presenting a metaphor that doesn't work.
Again, I think the movie's connection to reality is tenuous, and maybe this goes back to what you were saying about Escape from Tomorrow, that the movie is presented as sort of a dream that takes place over the course of one night where essentially the theme of the movie is everybody fucks except Tom Cruise.
No. I think it works much better as a dream.
And it's so literal in that scene. I mean, that's literally everybody fucks but me. And so it is a little heavy-handed.
I mean, the stylization of this.
Sure.
With the clothes and the masks and the stuff, it's...
Yeah, no, that I don't know why those specific things were chosen.
And then the irony is they slap it with an X
because
there's some rumpy-pumpy, and then they have to do digital nonsense.
Which has been it's removed on the Blu-ray, right? I believe.
It's so funny because Kubrick was such an irascible old coot.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know this. There was a contretemp about Clockwork Orange in Britain, and he said, okay, and it was never shown by him.
Yeah.
He said, fine, and wouldn't let them show it, and he was so upset about aspect ratios that for a long time he was deliberately keeping it in an aspect ratio that was wrong.
Right.
Which caused all sorts of problems after he died because the estate had directions and people wanted letterboxed because in a theater the thing was letterboxed.
Even Eyes Wide Shut, I think people claim is supposed to be 1:33, but I mean, I certainly didn't see it projected that way when I saw it. It's not what the Blu-ray is in. When I saw Eyes Wide Shut, that was the first Kubrick movie I had seen in a theater because his previous movie was Full Metal Jacket and I was too young to see it. I mean, there was such a gap. And at that time, Kubrick for years was the filmmaker who I felt like I just didn't get. That all these people loved him and I would see his movies and I would think they were fine, but I
because I think his films resist.
Yeah. And the older I get and the more times I go back to watch them, obviously the more of a fan of him that I become. And I've become a much bigger fan of Eyes Wide Shut in the last 10 years.
And maybe I need to watch it again because I remember I hadn't seen The Shining forever. And that was the last film of the massacre one year.
Right.
And I saw it in a theater again. And I was like, holy shit.
No matter what, I think you're always going to struggle with Eyes Wide Shut because of Tom Cruise. But Nicole Kidman is incredible in that movie. And you know whose performance I love in that movie?
Sidney Pollack.
Man, I'm sad that he passed away because he's not going to direct any more movies. But I miss him way more as an actor.
The rare times that he was an actor, and I'm thinking he's hilarious in Tootsie and arguably has one of the better punchlines.
Yeah.
But also he's in that Woody Allen movie?
Husbands and Wives.
And is very good.
Yeah. No, he's terrific. And he wasn't even, that wasn't his part, right? That was the Harvey Keitel part.
Yeah.
The shoot went on for so long that when they needed to do reshoots, people couldn't come back, and they were cut out of the movie. Jennifer Jason Leigh was reshot, and Harvey Keitel ended up being, I believe, reshot and replaced with Sidney Pollack, who is amazing in that movie. He's so great.
That movie suffers from, and I think Woody Allen is slowly getting away from this, that Allentar syndrome.
Yeah.
Because in Husbands and Wives, it's Judy Davis.
Right.
It's Judy Davis right. who's doing that.
But Blue Jasmine, Allen. there's none. There's nobody who's Woody Allen in Blue Jasmine, I don't think.
And in Bullets Over Broadway, it's John Cusack.
Right.
In Celebrity, it's Kenneth Branagh.
Oh,
it's
boy.
Really...
Is it ever.
It's
Scoop. He's in Scoop, but I think it's Scarlett Johansson.
Exactly.
In Scoop. Yeah, it's very weird.
And you wonder if
Scoop.
That's deliberate
yeah.
or if that's... I remember really liking Match Point, and I thought that was the point in his career that I'll keep going
right,
to a couple
right,
more.
Right, right, right.
Because what is that one? Oh, my God, is it Misbegotten?
Curse of the Jade Scorpion?
Yes.
Yeah, that's rough. And Match Point I like, but, I mean, the whole time I was just thinking, well, this is just Crimes and Misdemeanors,
yeah.
which is a much better movie. And I still like Match Point, but...
Would you agree that Crimes and Misdemeanors is his best film?
I'm a big Annie Hall fan.
And I'm wondering if Annie Hall falls prey to that syndrome where you've heard the song so many
sure.
times on the radio
sure.
that it's
sure.
worn away. Because
but,
I've told this story before. I was incredibly young when I saw that.
Yeah.
And can't believe, looking back, how it ever could have spoken to me because it's about so many things I
right.
had not experienced. But I was a precocious youngster. What you said about Eyes Wide Shut, whenever Crimes and Misdemeanors is on cable,
yeah.
drop everything.
Yeah. If it's not Annie Hall, it's that one. I've talked about this book a bunch of times. There's a book called It Don't Worry Me about all these great filmmakers and some of the movies they made in the 70s by a guy named, a British author, I believe, named Ryan Gilbey. And he writes an essay on Annie Hall that makes me like the movie more because it talks so much about the things that he did in that movie sort of stylistically that are, like, revolutionary.
And interestingly enough, and I might have brought this up on a previous podcast, my high school film study teacher turned me on to this book. And I remember buying it because I was really pushing for my son to see it. It's called When the Shooting Stops, the Cutting Begins by Ralph Rosenbaum. And he was Woody Allen's editor for a number of films.
Yeah.
He's the one who saved the producers.
Right, right.
That Woody Allen had shot in a wheelbarrow full of stuff.
Yeah, and Hedonia.
And it was all over the place. And it was Rosenblum who said, the through line is the
yeah.
relationship with Diane Keaton, and you can get rid of everything else. Because originally it was a much longer film about Allen's character being incapable of enjoyment.
Yeah, that's and stories like that are so amazing, that here you have this great film that almost didn't exist because one guy...
And God knows, it could have been Curse of the Jade Scorpion.
I tried to come up with a Woody Allen movie for this discussion, but it's impossible because he has...
And you hate interiors?
I'm not a fan of interiors.
Okay.
No.
I really like interiors.
Yeah, no, I could do without the whole Bergman period.
I like interiors a lot. I'm wondering if I like interiors because it mirrors my family.
But he doesn't... Well, the thing with Woody Allen, he doesn't have movies that are sort of... flawed. He has, like, that's pretty good, or that's awful. There's not really that middle. This is interesting, but...
And speaking of missteps, you have to give the Woodman credit. He pretty much makes a film a year.
Yeah.
There's no possible way.
Right.
But actually, that speaks to something that I wanted to bring up, that
okay.
I was thinking about John Ford, who's
okay.
another one of my favorite directors, and I was looking for missteps, and it occurs to me that it's an unfair comparison, because in the golden... age of Hollywood, you would make a film or two a year.
Right.
And you made all sorts of things.
Right.
And so no one has that opportunity anymore.
Right.
So it might be an unfair comparison. And I also, strangely enough, looked at the career of one Ron Howard.
Ah.
And I concluded that every film was a misstep.
Yeah.
And that he's really only made one good film.
I think he's made a few that are good to decent to good. I mean, I know you're speaking of Apollo 13, I assume.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I think there's lots to like in Parenthood. I think Splash is good for what Splash is. I think Night Shift is actually not bad.
Splash does not age well.
That's possibly very true.
And I actually really like the old-fashionedness of Backdraft.
Yeah.
except for the technology behind the special effects, that could be a 40s movie.
Yeah, well, then again, that was one of Ron Howard's strengths for a little while. The dialogue in that movie is particularly bad, and it could do without the whole murder mystery subplot.
Oh, yeah, you don't need that at all.
But it's Backdraft came out in, like, 91, and when we were doing F This Movie Fest this year, it occurred to me that 91 must have been the year where I somehow had some autonomy and saw every movie that came out 7 times, because I saw Backdraft so many times in a theater that I can recite it.
Would you also agree that the Robert De Niro, Donald Sutherland subplot is a little much?
This is what I'm saying. The whole murder subplot, the whole murder mystery is, you don't need it. Just make it about firefighters.
But I'm wondering, you had brought up Parenthood, which I remember liking a lot when it came out, that my affection for that film has more to do with the performances and the script.
Sure.
For a long time, if I was happy with how the show that I directed at the high school went, on one of the last performances when you talk to the cast before they go out on stage, I would quote the grandmother's speech at the end of that.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you're in this endeavor that's really difficult, but you're the better for it when it's over.
But again, what makes that speech particularly amazing is Steve Martin's punchline after it.
That's good. But I also really enjoy, as an adult, that whole, my whole life is have to.
Mm-hmm.
And that thing. But the roller coaster versus the merry-go-round, oh, man.
Yeah.
And it spawned what apparently is a successful TV show.
Well, it spawned one unsuccessful TV show.
So I thought...
There was a sitcom called Parenthood that came out shortly after the movie and went nowhere. Ed Begley Jr., I believe, was the Steve Martin part.
Okay, you ready for this? Yeah. Now I'm in my dotage.
Okay.
I thought the new show, apparently, which is like an hour-long dramedy...
Yeah.
...was that show, and it had been on for that long... I swear to God.
How did I miss this? This is the longest running show on TV.
But Dax Shepard would have had to start that show when he was 3. I honestly thought.
He was Mary Steenburgen's baby at the
how
end.
How many years? How many years is that?
Parenthood came out in 89. Show was probably on in 90 or 91.
So I thought.
So 22 years. Yeah. It's been on the air for 20.
I thought Parenthood had been on for 22 years. Oh my God, I'm disconnected from reality.
No, that is not the same show. Who's next on your list?
Okay, speaking of more recent directors, I thought I would bounce the following two off of you. Let's take them one at a time.
All right.
Darren Aronofsky.
Okay.
I'm thinking if you like Aronofsky,
yeah,
you would see The Fighter as the misstep, because it's so different.
He's not The Fighter. That's David O. Russell. Right? That's the boxing, Mark
no,
Wahlberg?
No, I'm getting the title wrong.
Okay. The Wrestler.
Yes.
I'm sitting here thinking, like, I know what you're saying, but this isn't right.
I think the people who are really into Aronofsky, The Wrestler would be the misstep.
Right.
But it's the only film of his I like.
Yeah, and I couldn't even do this game for him only because... I'm not passionate about any of his movies. I like The Wrestler, the best of them.
Well, it's odd that you put it that way, because I am passionate about his movies.
Right.
Passionate about my hatred.
I'm not passionate in either direction. But I would say The Wrestler is my favorite of his movies, although I have never... I saw it the first time, and then I felt like, okay, I'm good.
So in terms of David O. Russell, I think Adam's absolute love of Silver Linings Playbook has gotten me to at least revisit the film.
Okay.
And it seems to me, and help me out here, because I think I've seen every one of his movies.
Okay.
And it seems as if, as opposed to Aronofsky, who sort of makes one thing and then tried something else, it seems like David O. Russell is actually evolving to be something different than he was.
Yeah.
So he starts out twee and indie.
Right.
And that's sort of Spanking the Monkey and Flirting with Disaster, and especially I Heart Huckabees.
Well, you're skipping over Three Kings.
Which is odd, because you think if any of these things made sense, the three films I said would have come.
Sure.
Now, I really like Three Kings.
I think Three Kings is a masterpiece.
And can't understand why it doesn't get shown and talked about, and it seems to have disappeared except for my shelf.
Yeah, people don't... I mean, I know some of it is soured because there was all that tension between him and Clooney, and obviously we're all on Team Clooney.
Clooney was angry.
Yeah, no, they did not get along.
Because O. Russell's a bully.
Right. And I believe has mellowed, but I don't know for sure. The thing is, when Three Kings came out, and even still, we're not really in a place in our country where we're willing to look at war, not as a joke, because Three Kings doesn't make war into a joke, but it does suggest, this is absurd. Yes. What are we doing? In the 70s, you could do that, which is why MASH is a success. We are not able to do that now. I don't think people want to hear what Three Kings is saying.
No, I think that's very insightful, because when you get to the end of Three Kings, and Wahlberg cannot get help, but can call home.
Yeah.
On those cell phones. Yeah. That's...
No, I think that movie's amazing. For me, David O. Russell, where he's gone, is unfortunate. And because I don't love Silver Linings Playbook, it's a little bit of a disappointment to me where you're saying he's evolved. It's like, I kind of like where he was.
I like the first hour of Silver Linings Playbook, and I think this has come up before. Patrick's alternative universe interpretation of Silver Linings Playbook would have made me like it a lot more, but would have disappointed the entire American public because it's the occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. I like the first hour a lot. So now that I know the chronology, was Three Kings a success?
It made money, yeah.
Was the relative success of Three Kings what allowed him to make I Heart Huckabees?
I think so. Again, I might have talked about this before on the podcast. 99, which is when Three Kings came out, was this year where you really felt like it was going to be the 70s all over again, because Paul Thomas Anderson makes Magnolia, Fincher makes Fight Club, Spike Jonze makes Being John Malkovich, David O. Russell makes Three Kings, and you're like, all these great filmmakers are poised to take over. And I think there was some studio buy-in from that, and so a lot of those guys got a bigger shot, and so Fox gives him money to make I Heart Huckabees, even though that movie has no commercial appeal whatsoever.
And I don't remember. What is your opinion of that film?
That, to me, for David O. Russell, would be the movie that I would point to as a movie that is flawed and interesting that I like, kind of, even though I couldn't necessarily tell you why. I just sort of appreciate that it exists at all.
It seems odd for the sake of oddness. It seems...
At times.
To be trying something that's not organic to him.
I think it's very much organic to him at the time. I don't know that that's who he is anymore. But
Dustin Hoffman's hairstyle.
Yeah, that's problematic.
And we might have talked about this before, but not on the podcast. I found myself liking the Wahlberg firefighter stuff.
Because his performance in that movie is amazing. He's so inconsistent, but he's so great in that movie.
And not understanding the Jude Law.
Right. Naomi Watts.
I don't...
It's been a while since I've seen it. It may not hold up at all.
So, there's Spanking the Monkey and Flirting with Disaster, and I think Flirting with Disaster is pretty funny.
Flirting with Disaster is incredible. Yes.
And then Three Kings, and then I Heart Huckabees.
Yes.
And what does he make after I Heart Huckabees?
I believe then it's The Fighter. Does he really take that many years off? I think he does. I think he tried to get a couple movies off the ground. I think his next movie is The Fighter.
And that's another thing you have to say about modern film directors. Man, some of them go, not just Tarantino, some of them go a long time between films. So there's The Fighter, and then Silver Linings Playbook.
And now the new one. So he's working on a
and
much
the new
faster
one's play. American Hustle.
Correct.
So I would correctly state that I Heart Huckabees is the misstep.
Yeah, Silver Linings Playbook to me is a movie that I think I like less than I Heart Huckabees. So I think we're just looking at them in different terms. But yeah, I think I Heart Huckabees is
very flawed. Wondering if in an earlier script incarnation of Silver Linings Playbook, we get something very different. And as you used to say, you can see the different color script pages.
Right.
That someone at the studio really wants the Cinderella story.
Yeah. Robert Altman made a lot of... bad movies, some really messy movies, and I haven't even seen O.C. and Stiggs, but I've seen The Gingerbread Man.
O.C. and Stiggs is a mess, and that's particularly disturbing because that sat on the shelf for a really long time. Yeah. But that's based on an incredibly successful series of short stories that were originally in the National Lampoon that were epic.
Yeah.
And certainly they should have seen that John Landis was the man to direct that film, because that doesn't work at all. The film I was thinking is Quintet, which no one has seen.
I've not seen Quintet. I'm familiar with it, but I've not seen it.
And it's odd, and Paul Newman wanted to work with him again after Buffalo Bill and the Indians. I actually really like Buffalo Bill and the Indians, but I know it's not for everyone. And Health.
I've not seen Health.
Which no one has seen.
Yeah.
And A Wedding, which I really, not really like. Not seen There's so much in A Wedding to like. Speaking of Criterion news, in December, Nashville's coming out as a Criterion disc.
Holy cow.
Very exciting.
The movie for me that is often pointed out as one of Robert Altman's worst, that again I actually like, is Popeye. That it was, you know, way too expensive at the time. It didn't make money. It's very eccentric and not a typical Robert Altman movie. But I think I'm actually a big fan of Popeye.
And again, the problem is so simple. People were expecting the cartoon, the animated cartoon. And he went back to the original comic strip, which was called Thimble Theater, and recreates it amazingly. Yeah. And the Nilsson songs are charming.
Love the songs, love the locations you're always talking about. It feels like you go on a vacation, and that's what that movie feels like.
You'll agree that all that nonsense at the end with the squid it has to have a climax of some sort, and he has to eat spinach.
Right.
But what if Altman had really stuck to his guns?
Yeah.
Because the spinach is a very small part of Thimble Theater. In fact, Popeye was a very minor character in Thimble Theater and then later grew. That if we don't need that nonsense.
Right.
And that it just is 2 hours of this crazy town where the people are unusual looking.
Well, right. But you get all these, I mean, you have all the Robert Altman company and Robin Williams, you know, who would eventually become an actor I'm not a fan of. And I know he's not a fan of Popeye. He had a bad time making it and was possibly on drugs most of the time.
I was going to say, it was very hard to get quality cocaine in Malta.
But I really like his performance, and Shelley Duvall is something else in that movie. I'm a fan of that movie.
And I know when it came out, some people were unkind to Prairie Home Companion.
Sure.
But I really like it, especially because I feel he knew.
Yeah.
And that's all over the movie.
Yeah, that definitely colored my viewing of it.
Not to get pretentious, but a lot of people think that Shakespeare knew that The Tempest was it. And that what The Tempest is really about is the magician putting everything back in the bag and saying goodbye. And I think that's true for Altman. Although I used to drive my mother to church and would listen to that radio show.
Yeah.
Have you ever listened to that radio show? I don't think you're allowed to, because you're too young. That is the oddest goddamn radio show I've ever heard. And I'm convinced it's very popular with people who want to pretend it's the past.
Okay.
Because it's very comforting.
Right.
We still get this catalog. I don't know how we originally got it. It's called the Vermont Trading Company.
Yeah, I know of it.
And it's clearly for older people,
right?
Because it has candy they don't make anymore and comfortable house coats. But I was making the joke to Jan before that as their audience gets older and older, the product descriptions are becoming even more on the nose for why they're in this catalog. And one of them was like, manual typewriter keyboard. This works just fine. That they should just rename the catalog Coot.
Anybody else?
Some wax lips.
Anybody else on your list?
Let me see. We have talked about Hitchcock.
Yeah.
We've talked about Scorsese.
Yes.
My God, Patrick, the territory we've covered on this podcast.
What a crazy journey it has been.
Have you noticed lately that in the last 5 years that's become the metaphor for everything?
What a crazy journey it's been?
Well, not necessarily crazy, but the journey.
Everything's a journey.
It's been a journey.
Well, right, because everybody's trying to give their life more import than it actually has. So it's like, it's not my life, it's a journey. I'm on a journey. It's like, so this excuses any mistakes I make, see, because it's a journey.
And one stumbles exactly. on the journey. So you're saying that personally you feel that it will probably be aliens eradicating any
that's correct.
Any proof of our that's short time
that's
on
correct.
This land. We talked about Hitchcock, we talked yep. about Scorsese, we talked about Spielberg, we talked about Ron Howard. We talked about Kubrick, we talked about Aronofsky, and we talked about David O. Russell.
The last one that I would mention, and then we can wrap up, is David Lynch. And again,
I knew you were going to get David Lynch.
We've done a podcast on it, so I won't spend too much time on it. I know it is his misstep. I know it is deeply flawed, but I still like Dune.
And this came up recently on the website. No. It didn't. I'm quoting my own column. This came up in one of my columns, which you know I obsessively go back and reread because I really like quality literature about film. That Dune is a mess.
Yeah.
And I've actually seen the TV expansion.
Okay, I have not.
Which is interesting and odd.
Yeah.
But I actually read that book in high school and thought it was kind of cool.
Yeah.
And he got himself in a position where the only people who could understand the movie were people right. who had read the book and hated what he did.
Right.
And then if you hadn't read the book, what the hell is that big penis floating right. in that big aquarium?
Right.
Oh, it talks.
I think there's so much of him in that movie, and it's very rare that a director like that sort of steps up to do some sort of big budget, particularly a genre movie, and retains so much of what makes them interesting as a filmmaker.
And I have to give it to Dino De Laurentiis and his daughter for giving him
right.
that free hand, because right. the production design alone is yeah. makes that film worth right. seeing. But in the back of my mind, there's this niggling thought in my lizard brain that Dune kept us from seeing
his Return of the Jedi?
His Return of the Jedi. Can you imagine?
No.
Well, he would have been removed from the
exactly.
film.
Exactly. So I'm kind of glad that we got Dune instead, because that's his Return of the Jedi. That's what his Return of the Jedi would have looked like. Jabba the Hutt would have been an aquarium penis that talked.
I was going to say, sometimes when I'm in a particularly jovial mood, I try to imagine David Lynch's Ewoks.
Yeah, right.
And I imagine them emerging from the earth, sort of like a Viet Cong from tunnels, and they're covered in some sort of slime,
yeah.
and they all talk backwards.
And they would all come out, they'd be very small, and they would just laugh at you and laugh at you until you blow your head off, like the end of Mulholland Drive. Spoilers for Mulholland Drive. I still like Dune. I can't defend it.
Speaking of missteps, yes. I love David Lynch, and I proclaim this from the mountaintops that I used to subject high school students to Eraserhead. Not your semester, right?
No, I saw it.
And, oh my God, I've seen that film 50 times and love it. And I love all of David Lynch's films. And it's my love of David Lynch. It's my love of all things David Lynch. I have never seen Inland Empire.
Yeah, that's my least favorite of
his
movies.
I'm afraid to.
Yeah, it's definitely my least favorite of his movies. And somebody in the comments was just saying it was their favorite and made me think, maybe I should watch it again. But boy, it's a tough movie to watch a first time. I can't imagine sitting down to see it a second time.
And I remember we did a podcast on Lost Highway, which you should all listen to. Which I was always a really, really big fan of. But I remember the night we did the podcast, you were throwing out all these ideas mm-hmm. about your interpretation of it that really even made me like it more.
I love that movie very much.
And at some point in the last month, I saw Mulholland Drive again. And my God, that film is a box full of riches.
Yeah, David Lynch is one of those directors. It's not true of all of his movies, but there are a few filmmakers whose my favorite movie of theirs is whichever one I'm watching.
Yeah, you had said that about Tarantino.
Yeah, and David Lynch, it's Blue Velvet, it's Mulholland Drive, it can even be Wild at Heart sometimes, because I'm a big fan of that movie, and it's Lost Highway. I think any four of those on a given day could be my favorite David Lynch movie.
There are moments in all of David Lynch's films that completely bypass your conscious mind and it is some of the scariest,
yeah.
truly
yeah.
scariest stuff. Not jump out and say boo, but this, you're going to carry this in your brain.
Yeah.
And I'm not just talking about the scary homeless person in Mulholland Drive.
Even though it's the scariest thing ever.
No, it's the scariest thing ever. And I think a lot of that is in the editing. But also, every time I think of that theater and Silencio,
yeah.
I just get chilled.
Yeah. No, it's an amazing movie. All right, I guess we should wrap up then our discussion of director missteps. If you guys have your own that you want to nominate in the column, or in the comments, I should say.
Yeah.
Please do.
Because I'm very interested because...
Be nice.
We sort of came up with this idea, and I think this was very interesting.
It was fun to talk about.
And we appreciate you listening. Don't ever think that we don't appreciate it, because we do.
Bye, guys.